John, you ready?
Not, I'm going to that website.
Okay, so we can gavel in while you go to your website. Okay.
Okay.
We are going to open the informational meeting today for the House Subcommittee on Education Innovation. Today is, I believe, January 23rd, and we have an interesting agenda today, I believe. The focus of today's informational meeting is to learn about how schools are financed, how we can get information, and I did ask all my colleagues to bring your laptops, so this is going to be an interactive demonstration. And as all good teachers and students, please ask your raise your hands or make sure that you're able to follow along. And if we all get lost, our people that are helping us will help us find our way again. So I appreciate your willingness to give this a try, and so that we're not just, I call this in education ease, you know, rather than a sit and get, we're doing an interactive, hands-on demonstration of how we can access information about our own districts. And with that, I'm going to introduce Brian Reeder. Brian is the Assistant Superintendent of Special Projects and Legislative Research at the Department of Education. It's been my pleasure to work with Brian during the last session on revenue, and we'll also be following up somebody else that works with the Revenue and Ways and Means Committee at a regular basis in this legislature. And so with that, Brian, I don't know if you want to give us a little bit of your background and how long you've worked for the department, and how are you so fortunate to have this job, but welcome.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Brian Reeder, Assistant Superintendent at the Department of Education. I've been at the department for 7 years now. Prior to that, I was at the Department of Revenue as a tax economist for 10 years. My background is in economics and public policy. With that, I came here today prepared to do two things. The first would be an overview of the state school fund, and the second is a demo of the database initiative, what we call DBI, which is the data that the department collects and posts on the web for use by everybody. So at the chair's pleasure, I can do them in either order, whichever you prefer.
Well, Mr. Reeder, if you want to give the overview first, because I know I'm already distracted by my screen, maybe we need to set our laptops aside to listen, or whatever order you want. Or we could start with the DBI since we're all geared up and ready.
Well, actually,
your preference.
The overview first may make more sense.
Okay, let's do it that
and
way.
And then we can launch into the detailed data.
I'm kind of a high at-risk learner, so my attention span gets swayed easily.
Okay, this is going to be, I hope, fairly quick. And
do you have handouts on this, Brian?
I don't have handouts. My understanding is that you would
can email it.
That you would have them. I can email them to you right now.
Yeah.
They're at our desk.
All lined up. I thought that they had been provided.
Yeah,
okay, great. So really I want to talk about three things today, and as it relates to funding of Oregon schools. First of all, where the money comes from to finance K-12 education in Oregon. Second, how much money is it? And third, how do we get it out to the districts and the ESDs? Really, there's three sources of revenue. The first, what we call local, or more technically local and intermediate. The intermediate means cases where one level of government may give money to another level of government. We have examples in Oregon where cities have contributed to school budgets, where we have transfers between ESDs and school districts. Those are what we call intermediate revenue. But it's really dominated by property taxes in Oregon. That's the single largest source of local money for schools. The other sources are tuition, fees, and charges. Tuition occurs when, for example, a student from out of state comes to Oregon to go to school, and they would pay tuition to the Oregon School District.
Brian, can we take a moment?
Absolutely.
Representative Dolan, you have a question?
Mr. President, do you want questions as we go, or would you...
Yeah, questions as we go is fine. I'm not one of those people who has to start over if I get interrupted.
When you say intermediate money, and we look at the total package, you're going to get to where it's equalized. If we have a city or another municipality, even the state government last year with the money to Portland, is that computed into the equalization formula then?
Chair Comp, Representative Dahlem, the formal arrangements where we have revenue sharing between, for example, ESDs and districts, the answer is yes. But less formal arrangements where, for example, a city government may provide services or even money to a school district, I don't believe those flow into the formula. Those are relatively small amounts of money. I guess I don't know the answer in all cases. But some intermediate money would, but I think there are some cases where it wouldn't. But I certainly can give you a more definitive answer if I had a chance to review the law.
Thank you.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brian, in my school area, there's a lot of transfer. Is there an extra? Does the school district pay if a extra? How does that balance out if a kid from the Redmond district wants to go to Sisters?
Chair Comp, Representative Wisnett, when you mean transfer, you mean a student who lives in one district but attends in another district?
Yes, sir.
There's two ways that those arrangements work. The first is what we call an inter-district agreement, and that's a formal agreement between districts that says this student who lives in Redmond is going to attend in Bend. And in that case, we send the money through the funding formula directly to Bend, to where the student attends. The other type of arrangement is what we simply call a contract, and in that case, the student retains their residency for funding purposes where they actually live, and that district would pay tuition to the district where the student attends.
I have a comment for the chair that this is another example of where the student's not really attending the school, but the school's getting paid for that student.
Well, and if I might comment, and Brian, if you'll correct me, if it's a policy within those districts and it's an agreement within those districts, yes, you're correct.
Chair Comp, Representative Wisnett, when there's a contract that exists and a student attends in a different district in which than they live in, typically that contract will require a tuition payment. So you're correct. Even though the student is not attending in the district where they live, that district is getting the money, but then they pay it on to the other district. If they didn't, it's unlikely that other district would be willing to take that student. Now, in a case where there is no contract, but the student attends in a different district, we don't pay either district, because they have, without a contract, they are not, they don't qualify for school funding where they live because they're not attending there, but they don't qualify in the other district either because there's no contract or inter-district agreement in place.
Now I can tell by the expression you've piqued their curiosity. Representative Dahlem, clarifying question?
But then if a district were student starved and needing to maintain their student population for funding purposes or needed to grow, then it would be to their benefit to simply report that student as in attendance and not be too concerned about the address, wouldn't it? Does that happen?
Well, Chair Comp, Representative Dahlem, it may happen, but my feeling in looking at the data and the way we collect the data is that it's a rare thing. A district can't simply claim a district for funding simply because that student attends in their district. In order to get the funding for a student who lives in a different district, an agreement has to exist. And the district where the student lives will want to claim that student for funding. And they both can't claim them. Our system won't allow that. We keep track of, you know, we gather this data at the student level. So we, you know, one of our requirements is that a student be funded in only one district.
I'm going to ask that you write your questions down, because we do have, and please, we will come back to them. But if Mr. Reeder could continue with his presentation, maybe some questions might be answered or not, then we'll come back to those after he gives his overview.
Okay. And then the last category here, private donations. There is a fair amount of that going on in Oregon schools. The dollar amounts are not terribly large, but you know, contributions from foundations or individuals to school districts do represent a source of revenue, and those revenues are not considered in the formula, so those are additional revenues to the district. Second source of revenue, Oregon schools, and the largest source, of course, is state revenue, and it really comes in four different flavors. The state school fund is the largest by far, on the order of 2.6 billion dollars a year, roughly. The common school fund, which is generated, it's the investment earnings on the common school fund are directed to education. State managed timber receipts come from the sale of timber on state-owned timberlands. And then the state does make grants directly to school districts. Those amounts are relatively small compared to the state school fund, but there are state grants. And then federal revenue, really three sources of federal revenue, or three types. The first are direct grants to school districts. The second are grants that come to the Department of Education and then are passed through to school districts. And then the third one is federal forest fees, which have been in the news recently, and we can talk a little bit about a little bit more about those if you like. Here is a comparison of revenue by those three sources, local and intermediate versus state versus federal, back in 1990-91 compared to 04-05. And these data from school district audits, and that's why 04-05 is the most recent we have, because that's we're just now getting the data from the 05-06 school year audits in. And the reason I show you this is to show you the dramatic shift in the source of school funding in Oregon back in 1991, and that year is important because it was the last year before Measure 5 began to affect school property taxes in Oregon. Over 66% of funding in Oregon schools came from local sources, primarily local property taxes. Today, it's in the mid 30%, with the state making up the difference. So the state went from 27% back in 1991 up to over 50% today. And then, as you see, the federal share is relatively small, but it has grown a little bit over that period, from around 6% to over 10%. So the state school fund really is the focus of school funding for the legislature, and so I wanted to present some more information here. It's really comprised of two sources of revenue: the state general fund, which is primarily personal and corporate income taxes, and then lottery revenue. And today, the lottery represents about 10% of the total, and the general fund represents 90%. State school fund is the largest single source of revenue for districts and ESDs in Oregon. It represents over 50% of all operating funds. Now, let me back up. Over 50% of all operating funds come from the state, and over 90% of that is from the state school fund. This gives you a recent history of the level of the state school fund, and I show you this to sort of give you a sense for the roller coaster ride we've been on in Oregon since the 01-02 school year. 01-02 was a pretty good year in terms of school funding in Oregon, but then the recession hit us pretty hard. And so in 02-03, we saw that rather sharp drop in the state school fund. The next 2 years are an interesting phenomenon, too. In the 03 session, the legislature front-loaded the amount of money for the to be distributed to schools into the first year based on the assumption and hope that ballot measure 30 would pass and we would have more money in 04-05, the second year. Well, that didn't happen. And so, again, we saw this seesaw pattern where we had more money in the first year of the biennium, less in the second. So we've been sort of on this up-and-down path the last two biennia. What you'll notice, though, is if you look at the expenditure data, how districts actually spent their money, they smoothed that out, and they did that by developing or building reserves, particularly in 03-04. They built reserves based on the fear that Measure 30 wouldn't pass, and they, in fact, were correct. And so looking back on that period of building reserves, they look pretty smart at this point. Okay, a little bit about how we look forward in terms of funding schools or setting the level of the state school fund. Based on an executive order issued by Governor Kitzhaber, the School Revenue Forecast Committee generates an estimate of what's called the essential budget level. And the basic concept of the essential budget level is to estimate how much the state school fund needs to be in the coming biennium to fund the same level of services provided in the current biennium. And in doing that, that committee takes into account inflation, enrollment growth, and also the growth in local revenue. So if local revenue is growing very rapidly, then the amount the state needs to kick in, the state school fund, will be lower. On the other hand, if local revenue is growing slowly, then the state portion needs to be higher. And this slide sort of shows the actual numbers that were arrived at. The essential budget level for 07-09 starts out with the level of state and local resources in the prior biennium, 05-07, adds inflation and enrollment growth, takes out the level of expected local revenue in 07-09 to arrive at how much the state school fund needs to be to provide the same level of services that were provided in 05-07. So that's sort of the roll-up of, it's a current service level concept, the same kind of concept that state agencies use in planning their budgets.
Penny?
Yes, question, Brian. Representative Dahlem.
Could we see a percentage increase rate per annum or?
That $720.6 million is about 9% over the biennium, which is about 4.5% a year.
And is that rate of growth the mean, the mode? Is that normal?
Well, there is no normal here, unfortunately. The way that's arrived at is the School Revenue Forecast Committee looks at trends and expectations about the PERS rate, about teacher, administrator, classified employee salary and benefit increases, inflation in supplies, and so forth. It looks at all those separately and also looks at enrollment growth and comes to this sort of overall rate of growth. Now, as we know, the PERS rate has been bouncing around a little bit. Health insurance costs have been growing fairly rapidly. Salaries have been really seen modest growth, primarily because inflation has been pretty low. And enrollment growth typically averages between 0.5% and 1%, really closer to 0.5% in a typical year in Oregon. So you take a composite of all those growth rates to arrive at this.
Representative Minnis,
thank you. Going back to the timber reef seats you mentioned earlier, have we seen an increase in those receipts? Are they level or have they dropped? Or what is the status of those?
Chair Comp, Representative Minnis, there's really two sources of the timber receipts, Oregon-owned timberland.
Right.
And I don't have those specific numbers with me, but my recollection is that those receipts have been fairly stable over time. They're a little bit tricky to forecast because they're based on revenue when the timber is actually harvested. And there are cases where the state will sell the right to harvest timber, but then the timber will never be harvested because of economic conditions. So it's a little tricky to forecast the timber harvest. But in general, those receipts have been fairly stable over time, as have the receipts from federal timberland. But as you may have heard, that legislation for the federal timber receipts has not, as of today, been renewed by Congress, and so those may go away starting in this coming year, I believe.
Yep. They've got their last.
And that's on the order of $32 million a year. In federal timber money.
Okay. Representative Roblin?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to Representative Dolan's question, though, over the past 10 years, that essential budget level increase that's been necessary has been around 4%, is it not, each year?
Chair Comp, Representative Roblin, in the last 5 or 6 years, it has been in that ballpark with the PERS, the PERS rate has been changing, and that's really been the real wild card with that rate is what the PERS rate is doing. And if you go back very far, the PERS rate was dramatically lower, and so it we really haven't been doing this exercise, the essential budget level exercise, all that long.
Okay.
But yeah, over that period, it's been fairly stable with the exception of the PERS rate.
Representative Wisnett?
Yes, ma'am. I was holding my questions because you asked us.
I know, but some people just.
I apologize.
Happy,
for my colleagues.
You know, burning desire to hear it.
Go on.
So you're going to wait?
It's you're the chair. I'll
chair, you can decide.
Yes, we're going to wait. Brian, finish. What, Representative Ballard?
I'd like to thank Representative Wisnett. Keeping Arnie and I in line.
That's true. I appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate that, too, as somebody that, is sometimes slack on discipline, so.
The Colonel.
Thank you. Oh, the Colonel will handle it, yes.
Okay, so this slide gives you a sense for the sources of what we call formula revenue. And formula revenue is all the revenue that gets distributed through Oregon School Funding Formula. And formula revenue is really divided into two pots, what we call local revenue, and that's sort of a bit of a misnomer because some of those revenues have their original source in state or from the state or from the federal government. They're not only local taxes or local fees, but they come directly to local governments through revenue sharing programs. So those are called local revenue. And then on the state side, there's simply the state school fund.
Well, and then I have a question, Brian. But the final total formula, you don't have included with the federal title funds?
No, not on this federal
slide.
Title funds. The only federal money in here is the federal forest fees.
Okay, thank you.
But those go directly to districts, and so they're counted as local revenue in the formula.
Okay, just for clarification for myself, so then like the federal title funds, do they go to the department or do they go to local districts directly?
My understanding is, and I'm not an expert on federal programs, but I believe the title funds come through the department and go through the
districts.
Department to the districts.
Okay.
By the heads are nodding behind
okay.
you.
Okay, so really those two big sources, those two big pots of money that flow through the formula, and they're in 06-07, that's right around $4 billion, about 7.9 for the 05-07 biennium. And you'll see on the right-hand set of columns labeled the governor's proposed budget, you'll see down here, there's the roughly $6 billion that's
okay.
in the governor's proposed budget. If you add the $400,000 proposed for the local option equalization grants, this comes up to exactly $6 billion, which is the governor's proposal. But what this shows you is that by far and away, the largest source of local revenue is local property taxes. Representing, I don't know what percentage that is, it looks like well over 90% of all local revenue is local property taxes. And it's roughly half the size of the state school fund. So the state is the predominant funder of schools in Oregon. The Department of Oregon administers the formula. We send out the money to districts and ESDs, and the way this works is we take all of that money, the local money and the state money, and we determine how much each district gets. So for example, if a district is entitled to, through the formula, $10 million and their local revenue is $5 million, then the state will give them the remaining $5 million. If their local revenue were only $2 million, then the state would give them $8 million. But the point, and this is an important point to make, is that, and it's one that there's some misunderstanding about, the formula distributes all the money, not just the state money.
Mm-hmm. I'll ask the question.
Was that your question?
I won't ask
it. You're going to, okay.
I'll wait.
Thank you, Representative Roblin.
And the formula does that largely on a per weighted student basis, and we'll talk in a minute about what a weighted student is. So just sort of a summary here. The formula distributes most local revenue, most state revenue, and some federal revenue. About 80% of all the operating money that districts get comes through the formula. The remaining 20% comes from state grants, federal grants, local option levies that do not flow through the formula. About 95% of the formula revenue is distributed on a per weighted student basis, and the remaining 5% is distributed through three grant programs, the transportation grants, the high cost disability grants, and the facility grants. Even though those three grants are part of the formula, they are not distributed on a per student basis. They're really distributed on a reimbursement basis. And of the total money that goes out through the formula, 95.25% goes to districts, school districts, and 4.75% go to ESDs. So that's the breakdown. Really, the purpose of Oregon's school funding system is to equalize funding in a way that adjusts for the costs that are outside control of school districts. So it's not just per student, it's per weighted student. And what the weights are about is to adjust for these costs that districts really don't have control over. So, and those costs really are, they fall into five categories. Students with special needs, which the two largest categories there are special education students and English as a second language students. Transportation costs vary tremendously around the state, primarily because of geography and the varying density of the student population. Geographically, large districts with very sparse populations have very high transportation costs per student, and the transportation reimbursement portion of the formula is designed to take that into account. We also give, the formula gives more money to districts that have small schools. The logic there being small schools are more expensive to run, and that in schools that are both small and remote, the alternatives, which would be to transport students very long distances every day, are less preferable than keeping the schools in the communities and giving them additional funds for their higher costs. Okay. The formula also adjusts for higher salaries that result from district salary schedules that give step increases based on experience. And then the facilities grant provides additional resources for districts that put new facilities in place and for them to buy equipment, lab equipment, desks, chairs, and so forth, things that are not under Oregon law, don't qualify for bonding, to be purchased with bonded funds. So how do we get more money to high-cost districts? Student weights is probably the biggest part of it. High-cost disability grants for special education students who cost more than $30,000 a year to serve, the transportation cost reimbursement, additional money to small schools, what we call a small school correction, and the mechanism there is to give them additional student weights for being small, the teacher experience adjustment, and the facilities grant. And here's the student weights, and this is important because it really is the factor that moves most of the money around. Every student in the state gets what is often called the first weight of one, what I've called the regular weight here, and then students with certain characteristics get additional weights. Special education students get a full additional weight, ESL students half an additional weight, students served by pregnant and parenting programs an additional full weight. And then those first three are based on actual individual student characteristics. The next three, the poverty weight, the neglected and delinquent weight, and the student in foster homes weight are based on district level or school level percentages or counts. They're not based on individual student characteristics, so they are counts provided to us either by the Census Bureau in the case of the poverty weight or by the Department of Human Services for the other two. And then the additional weights for small schools is based on their size as measured by ADM. And this is just a little detail on how each of these factors works. High-cost disability grant is a reimbursement program for expenditures above $30,000. Transportation grants are also a reimbursement program, which range from 70 to 90% of a district's eligible transportation expenditures. Small school correction gives additional student weights to the district. Teacher experience adjustment gives more money to districts that have higher than average teacher experience. I've got a slide here that I'll give you a little more detail on that in a moment. And then the facilities grant has been running it's a percentage of their investment to put new facilities in place, and it's been running at approximately 4%. So for every $1 million that a district spends on either new buildings or remodeling to provide new classroom space, they'll get roughly $40,000 through this grant to help equip the new space. So how does the formula work? we take this big pot of money, which we call total formula revenue, which is around $4 billion a year. We take off the top the amounts that go out through the transportation grant, the high-cost disability grant, and the facility grants, and then the rest gets distributed on a per-weighted student basis. So that's about $3.5 billion after you take these three grants out that goes out on a per-weighted student basis. So how do we arrive at the weighted students? And I know that Representative Wisnett will have a question after I say this. What we call average daily membership weighted is simply the sum of the first weight, which we call ADMR, just average daily membership, and then you add in the additional weights. And we do this at the district level. And then we say, we take a look, and under the law it says the district will be funded on their ADMW in the current year or in the prior year, whichever is greater. And the purpose of this, or the logic behind this, is that districts who are losing enrollment and therefore whose ADMW is falling over time have certain fixed costs that don't go away simply because they're losing students, and so they're funded on the prior year's higher number. And there's been some controversy and some discussion about that in recent years about whether that's appropriate or not. But the logic behind it is sort of a fixed cost argument and sort of giving districts an added year to adjust to that loss of enrollment. The one adjustment that that is part of the formula is the teacher experience adjustment that I referred to earlier. The way that works is that the amount of money per ADMW that a district gets is adjusted by $25 for each year of experience that the district's average differs from the statewide average. For example, the statewide average experience is about 13 years. If a district's experience is 14 years, they'll get $25 more for each of their weighted students through the formula than they would have if they had the statewide average. So we have some districts in Oregon that have dramatically higher or dramatically lower experience than the statewide average, and so they get funded at a higher or a lower level depending on where they fall. And here's really sort of the guts of the formula, and it, as you can see, it's not terribly complicated. You take the number of weighted students you have, you multiply it by $4,500 plus any teacher experience adjustment you may have in your district, and then you get an initial amount of money for your district. Now, that $4,500 doesn't vary from year to year. It's specified in law. And so we then, after we do that initial distribution, we say, have we given out all the money yet? And if we haven't, then we multiply it by this ratio so that all the money is given out. And in the current year, this ratio is something like 1.13, which brings the per student dollar amount up to about $5,700 instead of the starting point of $4,500. So, I mean, this is just the mechanics of it all.
Yes, sir. Brian, we have Representative Dahl.
Brian, we
six questions now.
Six.
We are going to answer Representative Wisnitz after Representative Dahl.
Six slides back, we talked about equity. Uh-huh. And you talk about an average distribution per student of $5,700. What's the deviation from that $5,700 plus and minus around the state? So how far out of balance can we be and still achieve equity?
Brian, can I? I'm going to ask that you wait for the DBI, the Database Initiative presentation comes up, because you will easily be able to see that in that presentation. Am I accurate in saying that?
Chair Comp, let me answer his question briefly, and then when we look at the DBI, we'll look at we can get a little further into it. If you spend any time with this equation, what you'll see is the only way that there's any variation at all in this general purpose grant across districts is the teacher experience adjustment. So every district in their general purpose grant is right around $5,700, anywhere from 56 to 58. They're all very close in there on a per weighted student basis. But because some districts have a lot more students who get extra weights than other students, when you express it on an actual student basis rather than a weighted student basis, you get more variation.
Thank you.
Representative Wisnett, did you want to jump in here?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just I have some questions. Are we through with this part before we go to the DBI?
Okay. The last part of the formula, once each district's general purpose grant has been calculated, then we add in the district's share of the transportation grant, the high cost disability grant, and the facility grant to arrive at their what we call the state school fund grant, which is the total amount of money that they're going to get through the formula. And then we get their total formula revenue. And then from that, we subtract their local revenue to find out how much we're actually going to pay them out of state funds. And again, if a district is entitled to $10 million and their local is $5 million, then we pay them the remaining $5 million. The formula distributes all the money, but since school districts already have some of it, this last part is just the cash flow part of the equation. Is they're entitled to a certain amount. They've already got some of it. The state pays them the rest. ESD formula is driven by the amount of money that each ESD's constituent districts get through the formula. So we figure out the distribution to each school district, and then we arrive at how much an ESD gets by multiplying that by a simple percentage. And then again, based on how much each ESD is entitled to through the formula, we subtract how much they collected locally to determine their payment from the state. Okay. And in the case where an ESD has more local revenue than they're entitled to through the formula, they take that difference and pay it out to their constituent districts. So, and just some contact information. The person at the department who administers the formula, his name is Mike Wiltfong, and there's his contact information there. If you have other questions that Mike can't answer for you, or larger questions beyond the day-to-day workings of the formula, you're always welcome to call me.
Okay. Thank you. Because we have several other people, we're going to be concise with our questions. But, Brian, when we transition, before you show us the database initiative, could you email our committee administrator, Rick, your presentation, and then he can email it to all of us so we have it?
I can, but I can't do it from here.
Right. Okay.
Okay.
You'd be doing it later. Okay.
Why can't you do it from there?
Because I don't have web access to my email back at the department.
Okay. Well, we just thought this Wi-Fi was going to get us everywhere.
Well, it will. Had I come prepared with the proper web address, I could do it, but I can't. I don't have that, so I can't log on through the department's web portal to my email at the moment.
Okay, thank you, Representative Wisnett. You've been very patient. So
thank
you're first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you've already asked my first question. Was a copy of the slides.
Okay.
Next, Mr. Reeder, could you give us back the essential budget slide?
Sure.
What's different, Mr. Reeder, about that than current budget level? Well, I mean, I thought we went away from funding on current budget level, and now we're using essential budget level. Is there really a difference?
Chair Comp, Representative Wisnant, no, there's no difference. It was simply a name change. We used to call this current service level. Now we call it essential budget level. My understanding is that the essential budget level term is the one used by state agencies, and the Revenue Forecast Committee was changed the name of it to be consistent with other state agencies. But it essentially is the same concept, and that is how much does it cost in the coming biennium to do what you did in the current biennium.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay. The next question was...
Follow-up, please.
I thought we were going to get through the whole thing.
Yes, you can go. Yes, please.
The follow-up question. Mr. Mars helped me comprise a list of the actual students in my phantom student bill, and I didn't realize, we've worked on this for a couple of years, I didn't realize a student could actually be three students. So that makes my bill even more justified when you're saying that on a declining enrollment, a student could be three, but that student next year is not here. So that school is getting paid for not one student, but three students. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Thank you. Also, could you give follow-up?
Yes, sir.
Could you give me the number of students we anticipate for the next school year versus the weighted students, like it's 550,000 students we have, and what's the weighted?
Yeah, Representative Comp, Representative Wisnant, actual students from our October 1 count of students this school year, 06-07, was roughly 563,000. And weighted students is 665,000, roughly 20% higher.
Okay. Thank you. The final question, Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
Brian, I know you're a tax economist. I have to ask you what that does, but could you comment on why and do you think teacher experience is justified in a distribution formula of equity to the students?
Chair Comp, Representative Wisnant, I don't have an opinion on whether it's justified or not. I mean, the logic of these kinds of adjustments is that school districts face certain costs over which they don't have control. Now, some people would say, given the rigid salary schedules that school districts use, that once a teacher is hired, the district no longer has any control over that person's salary. Other people argue that districts do have control based on who they hire. So I don't have a clear answer for you on that one. I do believe it is true that districts whose teaching staff has more experience face, on average, higher compensation costs simply because of the way salary schedules work. Whether it's justified in giving them more money is a harder question to answer. I don't have an answer to that question.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Chair Comp. I'm not a colonel, but I am a school teacher, and so I've also been following the rules and saving up my questions. And I'm not going to ask all of them. Perhaps I'll be in touch with your department to get some of them answered. But one of them also had to do with the central budget level. If essential budget level is not maintained, as I'm guessing was the case in the earlier part of this decade when school numbers didn't keep up with what was necessary to maintain services, does the following year's essential budget level number reflect that, the fact that there was a drop off, or would funding at EBL then keep at the low water mark? You understand my question, not posed very elegantly, but
Chair Comp, Representative Cannon, I do understand your question. It's one that we have talked about quite a bit, not only in the legislature but also in the Quality Education Commission. The essential budget level is always based on actual funding in the current biennium. So, for example, if the essential budget level for 05-07 were $7.5 billion, and I'm making these up because I don't remember the real numbers, but we only funded at $7 billion, then in the following biennium we start at 7, the lower number, not at 7.5. It's what, if you look at the most recent Quality Education Commission report, which is on the web right now, there's a graph in there that talks about the ratcheting down of school funding in Oregon, and it's precisely that phenomenon where if you don't keep up with the essential budget level, the base, in effect, ratchets down each year that you don't meet that level, and you don't catch up to where you used to be.
Representative Cannon, if Representative Minnis would like to give a little bit of a response and understanding to that question also.
Some of the, there's been a lot of discussion about the lesser funding that took place in 01. And what happened was the economy was tanking. We were going south in our capital gains, our dot-com bubble burst. We were off by 80% in our capital gains, and the legislature was frantically trying to get their arms around how much revenue was going to be available, and every time we thought we had a fix on it that we could balance the budget, the economy would continue to dive. And I remember sitting in the governor's office, and the forecast gentleman came in to give us the news, and we thought, we're probably another 100 down or so. When he came in and said it's $650 million, and this was May, that we had lost that much more money, the air went out of the room, and I remember sitting around the table looking at each other thinking, how are we going to respond to this? It was a very difficult time in Oregon's history. Prior to that, we'd also gone through 5 special sessions, and as a result of that, the decision was made that let's do ballot measure 30, let's do an income tax surcharge, and surely Oregonians will agree with us. This is the right course to take. I know that Speaker Simmons argued at that point to not put education under that cut because there was a concern that the voters would not agree that that was the course to take, and they would not agree that they were willing at that point. They were trying to put food on their table. They were not willing to give us more money. As a result of that and the failure of ballot measure 30, schools had to take that cut in the last 6 months of a 2-year biennium. Mm-hmm. So it was a huge, huge hit. And so I think that referral really impacted schools. It's not that people were unwilling to fund schools or any of that. It was just the way that was all set up. And then the economy tanking. And I think that speaks to why I believe we need to look at some stability in our funding and predictability so that our schools can plan out into the future and know that if they plan on a certain amount of money, that money is going to make its way here. And when times are good, we need to have a rainy day fund in place as well. And we talked a lot about that at length last session. But that's kind of what happened. And sitting in those meetings and listening to the leaders of the state trying to put their arms around the very difficult situation they were faced with. And with Oregon, once the economy goes south, we're very income tax dependent, and our revenues disappear quickly. So I think that speaks to kind of what happened, at least from the chair I sat in and listened to those conversations.
Thank you. Representative Cannon, did you have any other?
I just wanted to clarify, thank you, Chair Comp. I wanted to clarify that the local options are not included in the distribution formula, so that is a way for districts to locally add on top of what they're otherwise getting from the state. It's not factored into the local revenue column that affects their state funding.
Chair Comp, Representative Cannon, that's correct. Those are on top of any money they get through the formula.
Yeah.
We have Representative Buckley and then Representative Dahlem, and then I think we're going to see the database initiative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to, in response to Representative Minnis' comments, I wanted to point out that since Representative Cannon joined the legislature, we've had a lot more resources to put towards education, so I'm very pleased.
You're welcome, Representative.
Thank you for all your hard work. Representative Dahlem and Representative Roblin.
Sure. One of the areas that And I want to back up in the budget. It's state forest land. How does that money get into the school fund? I'm thinking particularly of the Elliott and the Tillamook Forest. How does that get into the school funding, and where does the authority for that money come from that it would be put in the school fund?
Chair Comp, Representative Dahlem, I don't know the nitty-gritty details of the law as it relates to the state timber money, but the money flows to districts located in the areas where the timber is actually cut. And so, for example, timber in the Tillamook Burn area would flow to the school districts who are located over there. So only a handful of districts in the state get any of that state timber money. In the statutes, the school funding formula statutes, ORS 327.013, defines local revenue to include those payments. So that's how they get into the formula, is that they are statutorily defined as being local revenue in the formula.
Go ahead, Representative Roblin.
The only exception to that in his question would be the Elliott, which goes directly into the state, the other school fund, the
Common School Fund.
And then that's distributed into the formula through the, well, it was the Department of Ed. I think it's not the Treasury. Didn't we change that last year? I can't remember the exact. Yeah. But it doesn't go directly to the schools, does it? The Elliott Forest Lands?
Chair Comp, Representative Roblin, I don't know the answer to that. Maybe okay. Steve Meyer will be able to answer that when he's up there. But
thank you, Representative Roblin. Follow-up?
Sure.
Madam Chair. Where I was going with this, with particularly the Elliott, was that if I want to know how much money is added to the Common School Fund, and what would we look at for money added to the Common School Fund if this were private forest land managed for schools? My question is, I think I see a source of revenue that we might be able to tap might offer some deliverance from this perennial school funding problem. And that's where I was going with it. But, Brian, I guess I'll have to go somewhere else and dig out this Elliott piece.
Yeah, I apologize that I don't know the answer.
Thank you.
One last one. Representative, for the good of the order.
This goes back to the question that began this series, and that is that because of that ratcheting down, had there not been ratcheting, had there been revenue, which we didn't have, over the period of times from those multiple special session years because of the budget to today, and we had just gotten the essential budget, and we hadn't gotten anything over it, just kept that on. Our current budget doesn't quite get us back to where we would have been. Is that true?
Chair Comp, Representative Roblin, that is true. I think that if you choose a starting point, and this you can find this in the Quality Education Commission report, and I believe the starting point for that calculation is 2001, and it said if we had actually funded the EBL every year, where would we be today? And it would be roughly $1 billion in the 07-09 biennium than what the current EBL actually is. So that ratcheting down has been about $1 billion over the last four biennium.
Okay. Thank you. Lots of very, very good questions. I don't know if your computers have turned off. Mine has.
No problem.
And so we probably need a moment to make sure we're all back onto the departments. Do we need to be on the department's webpage, Brian?
Yeah, the best place to start is the homepage of the Department of Revenue, which looks like this.
Oh, Department of Education? Yes, okay. Getting close,
John.
There we go.
What do you need?
Needs his mouth.
I hit his mouth. I'm sorry.
Okay, go ahead, Brian.
Okay, what I'll do is show you a couple of the tables, the financial tables that we have, but there's a lot of stuff out here, and you can look at that when you have time. If you go to the menu over on the left-hand side and just hover over the fourth or the fifth item down, which is called Reports, Data, and Statistics, and you'll get a pop-up menu when you hover over it. And then the second item in that pop-up menu says DBI Reports dash Table of Contents, and so go ahead and click on that. And what you'll get is a series of tables here in these broad categories, and these categories are in alphabetical order, and so we're going to scroll down to the finance slash funding category. And then the first table that I will point you to is the second one here, number 47, which is actual expenditures by fund and function. And if you click on that...
We're a little behind you, Brian.
Okay.
We're in finance.
Did you go back?
I need to back up.
Yeah, one.
Some of our fingers aren't as nimble as yours.
Reports
and funding. Okay.
Under finance and funding, which one do we want to go to?
Second one.
47.
Okay.
It's in alphabetical order, so.
I see the number, but I don't see the term.
47. Scrolling down.
Wait until we do testing on Thursday. Okay.
Are we all there? Okay, so what you get here is a choice of years, and even though 0506 you'll see here, we're just now getting that data in, so for most districts you won't find anything in there for 0506. So I'm going to have you choose 0405 and then hit that submit query button just to the right of the years. And now at this point you get more choices, and what I will recommend is first go down to the ESD list, and instead of all ESDs you want to click on no ESDs, so that what we're going to do is go select just a single school district to look at.
Okay.
And I'll let you choose whatever one you like, and I'll choose Salem-Keizer because that's where my kids go to school. And once you've selected a district, then go to the upper right, and there's an icon called View Report. And this gives you, the first thing you notice about these financial tables in DBI is they have a huge amount of detail in them. And that's both a blessing and a curse. Sometimes you want all this detail. Other times you'd rather have it summarized at a little higher level. And we're currently developing some new tables that are at a higher level that are a little easier to get your mind around than this level of detail. But what this really tells you is it shows you the level of detail at which we collect the data from school districts. And these categories over on the left, this is what we call our chart of accounts. It's the common definitions and categories used by every school district in the state, and that's what allows us to compare the financial data across districts, because they all use a common set of definitions when they report their data to us.
Very good.
Question, Brian?
Yes.
So if I was curious about alternative education, which is Fund 1280, is there a capacity or so that I could go into some query and ask, you know, what are the costs statewide for alternative education?
Do I have to answer that question?
No, but is there the capacity to do that?
Chair Comp, the DBI tables typically don't...
Go by function?
Well, they do go by function, but many of them don't have statewide totals.
Okay.
They present district-level data. I can provide to you statewide totals.
Sure. You could calculate the aggregate.
Right. But in many of these tables, they were designed to give the district-level detail, and they don't have statewide totals.
Okay.
That would be a thing that would be very useful to add to the website. But at this point, many of the tables don't have
Okay, it's not available. Okay. Representative Dahl?
The question, Brian, is going to be after the monologue. Wasn't that the original notion? I remember Governor Kitzhaber saying that legislators would sit at their desk with a computer, and I remember being in Lynn Lundquist's office at the genesis of this project, with legislators being able to say how much we're spending on books across the state. Was that the original drive of the whole program?
Chair Comp, Representative Dahlem, I believe that was part of it, yes. And I guess the commitment I would give to you is we are in the process of reevaluating a lot of these tables on DBI as to whether they're useful or not. And one of the things that I would like to see is that very thing, is that we get some state-level aggregates put into these tables. So, for example, instead of selecting a school district, you select statewide totals.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
A follow-up, and then Representative Minnis.
As a superintendent, that disturbed me greatly. But now as a legislator, I see its great value.
Appropriately stated. Representative Minnis.
Back in 99, we actually bonded, the legislature bonded for school books for schools. Do you have the information on that bonding and what the status is of it, and have we repaid those bonds? Do you remember that in 1999? Were you there in 1999?
Chair Comp, Representative Minnis, I'm sorry. I that was the year I came to the Department of Education, and I'm sorry I don't remember that.
Does anybody in the audience, do you guys know if that's been
Steve? Do you want to come to the podium? If you state your name.
For the record, Steve Meyer, Legislative Revenue Office. I think you're referring to the lottery back bonds.
Yes.
That were used.
They're for books. For schools.
I'm thinking of the number of years. About 4 years, if I remember correctly, something like that. Three or 4 years. That could be used for books, could be used for computer software, computers, construction, a whole list of things. Basically capital needs, since it was funded by bonds.
Right. So when it was presented to us as the purpose for books, the schools actually had more latitude to use it for other things, not just books.
Chair Comp, Representative Minnis, yes.
And so the next session, when people came back to us and said, we don't have school books or we don't have current books, that tells me then those school districts had that latitude and they didn't particularly use the money for that, or how does that work?
Chair Comp, Representative Minnis, the school districts did have the latitude within the whole list, so they could choose, if they didn't want to choose it, to spend it on books but on something else, they could do that.
Okay.
And those bonds were, I can't remember the term, I think 15 or 20 years, so they're not paid off yet entirely, I don't think.
Wouldn't be from 99.
So that's still a use of lottery funds.
All right, thank you.
Okay. Brian, did you have any last things you wanted to show us before we move on to Steve's presentation?
Well, I'll just show you one more thing very quickly. If you back up.
Before I go there, could I just say, when I look at Kate's, my school district, and they may have an alternative school, two charter schools, and so other. All that is in here. Are the charter school funds shown in here in any place? I don't see a charter school deal, and yet they are public charter schools.
Chair Comp, Representative Rollbone, yeah, the expenditures by charter schools are in here. In the very same categories that districts use for all their other schools. So in that sense, you can't isolate those particular schools. We do collect this expenditure data at the school level, but it's not all districts can provide it at the school level, so it's not entirely comparable but it is there for some districts.
Go ahead, Representative.
And another follow-up on the textbook question. Every year, a different group of textbooks become the group that has to be bought. And in a seven-year recycle, every 7 years you're going to buy a new set of textbooks. So if I was asking for textbooks 1 year, they could have been for math. And 2 years later when they came back, they could have said, I don't have my science textbooks, because they came due when my science books came here 2 years later. So I just wanted to make sure that people understand that. Also part of the system.
Right. Thank you, Representative Roblin. Representative Wisnett, Representative Buckley, and then Representative Cannon.
We get confused all the time, Gina. It happens. I'm sorry. Brian, I was going to ask, with this, in addition to the ability to compare to statewide figures, is there a step that's going to be taken to also add the sources of revenue for the school district, you know, how the formula is working for a particular school district in the future?
Chair Comp, Representative Buckley, I was about to show you this. We do have revenue side data in here.
Great.
If you back up a couple clicks back to the list of tables and look at number 95, which is the fifth one down under the finance section, it'll show you revenue by source.
Great. Thank you so much.
And again, you'll need to pick 0405 and choose no ESDs, and then choose your preferred district, and it'll show you.
You brought up Ashland.
Yeah, thank you. That, how do you know that was my preferred district? just a quick follow-up, too. Does that, because I'm not there yet, is there information on the number of students that are served as well on this?
Not in this table, but in other tables that you'll find in this very same list.
Thank you so much.
There's a wealth of information out here.
Yes. Representative Cannon?
Yeah, just a comment for the committee. The chalkboard project aggregates some of this data and gets us the higher level sorts of figures. So, for instance, on spending, and I think they're using the same data, at least they say the source is the Department of Education, they break it down so you can see for your district how much it's spending on the principal's office, central administration, teaching and student resources, buses, buildings, and foods, and business services and technology. Those are the five main categories. And then you can compare side by side, district to district or district to state averages. And that website is openbooksproject.org. And I know Representative Roblin knows quite a bit about that process.
Well, and I would just add to the comment, though, is when something's, if there's aggregate of information, and to really clearly understand what's happening in your school districts, it is much better, in my bias, to go and look at how it's broken down, whether, you know, and it's broken down so much better in a readable way, also to get, you know, how did they come up with those figures? Because sometimes something seems like that doesn't quite make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so if something doesn't make sense, there's usually a reason. So you need to go back to these tables to find out the why.
Yeah, that's right. Great. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Chair Comp, Representative Cannon, the Chalkboard Project, their website is based on our data,
right.
And the department worked very closely with them to make sure that the data were defined in the same way that we use them. And so they aggregate the categories slightly differently than we do in certain cases, but it is the very same data, and the totals do all add up. So their website is a very good tool to compare different districts, and they also provide statewide averages as well.
Good. Representative Dahlem.
I think Brian just answered my question. When they would aggregate data in a different way than you did have opportunity to comment and agreed with was what they were doing. So, and I think your final statement verified that we can trust the figures they give us.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's just a different way of looking at some of it. Okay. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
That was very comprehensive and a lot of information. We do have only 45 minutes left to this committee, and Steve, I don't know what your timeline is to give your presentation today.
Madam Chair, about 10 minutes.
You can do it in 10 minutes?
Wow. What a great guy.
Could we get some more reports from Steve?
looking at Corvus reports today.
For the record, again, Steve Meyer, Legislative Revenue Office. Brian covered virtually everything that I wanted to say quite well. But I would like to just take a few minutes to point out two or three slides that you have on your handout from me, with the first slide being school finance sharing state and local resources. If you'll turn to the third page, where the top slide is the individual education program, one extra weight. Just a few comments about two or three slides. We have been asked in the past, or legislators tend to ask in the past when they see these weights, how accurate are they? In 1991, when the formula was put together, there was virtually no information to base the weight choices on. There was a national study at the time dealing with special education that indicated that the special education weight should be about an extra one weight or so. So that was the only basis for choosing one extra weight for an IEP. Okay. So with all this additional spending data that you have seen on the screen, legislators tend to ask, well, what's the cost, what's being spent on these students versus the dollars associated with their weight in the formula? Right? Compare the two. Right? So that's what I've tried to do here, both for the IEP and the ESL. There's a two research reports out on the Legislative Revenue website, one dealing with each of these, that I've put together this last interim. But to just summarize quickly on the IEP, one extra weight, about 13.3% of students or of ADM are IEP students. The formula limits the IEP count to 11% of ADM unless districts go through the waiver process to exceed that amount. There's only about 25 districts that are below the 11% limit in the statute, 167 above. And waivers are currently allowed for about 4,500 extra IEP students above that 11% cap.
Could you state that figure again? How many?
4,500.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
So of all IEP students, about 89% are eligible for the additional one weight. Now, then it comes to, well, how's the spending on those students? But realize, too, that the dollars may be generated by those students, but there's no requirement that those dollars be spent for those students. Okay? But about half of the districts reported IEP costs less than IEP revenue. Okay? In the report, I included federal dollars on the revenue side, as well as ESD dollars that I could identify that were identified with the district. But for those districts that had revenue above costs, the gap was very narrow. The revenue wasn't much more than costs. For districts that had costs above revenue, the cost tended to be fairly high above revenue, a much larger gap than on the other side, okay? Which is, I think, to be expected from the results. And if you go to that research report, you can see those numbers district by district. For the ESL extra one-half weight, right, 124 districts reported ESL students. Again, ESL students are about 11% of ADM. And the average cost reported by districts for English as a second language students was about $1,500 per student. And this is for the 03-04 school year, by the way. And the revenue from the extra half weight was about $2,600 per student on average. And only 12 districts reported costs more than the weighted revenue. But just some highlights from the kind of information that you'll find in those reports if you want more detail.
Oh, just a minute, I'm sorry. We have several. Okay.
Yeah. Uh-oh. Well, I'm in trouble.
I don't know who was first. Oh, Representative Cannon.
Yes, thank you.
Chair Cohen. My question, if I understand you correctly, there's the IEP students are capped at 11% unless there's a waiver.
Correct.
But every district in the state is at that 11%.
Or above.
Or above.
No.
No.
Chair Cohen, Representative Cannon, 25 districts were below the 11% in 03-04.
Okay. Can I continue with you? Clarifying question?
There's what, 197 districts?
Yes. Okay. 198 in 03-04.
Okay.
But nearly every district in the state is at, which means that for those districts, this has actually no bearing on their distribution under the funding formula. It doesn't, it's not reproportioning. If they're all at or close to the 11% maximum, there's actually no variation on the basis of their IEP claim to the formula.
If 11% was the only...
Right.
Limit,
yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. Representative Dolan?
Yes, but Mike, when the formula was first drafted, the 11% was, or the weighted was arrived at to distribute revenue, not to spend revenue. And I think that point has to be made. It was a way to get the money out. Because of the differences in identified children, the differences in their handicapping condition, the differences in number that each district had, there was an estimate taken from a national study, and we used that to see to it that there was some equity in the distribution of money. There was never an attempt to pay dollar for dollar for costs incurred on an individual basis.
Thank you. Representative Roblin?
Yeah, and my question, I guess, would go to the ESL issue, and I don't know if you have this data, but you were saying that there were approximately, 26 districts that spent more than the allotment? The 2,600, and then there were a bunch of them that sent less.
Correct.
In that, those that spent equal to or more, is there any evidence, data on those students and how they performed as opposed to the ones that didn't spend that allocated amount?
Chair Cobb, Representative Rolum, I did not go that direction at all and okay. try to match up test results to gotcha. Those students.
Okay.
Let me just comment on the 11% also.
Okay.
In 91, when that was put in the statute, that was about the state average.
Right.
And the state average now is around 13%.
Right.
So, again, it was a way to force districts that were above 11% to justify increasing that count. And it was also a way to put some kind of cap on it to keep districts from trying to game the system and get more revenue.
Follow-up, Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the other question to follow up with what Representative Dolan was saying, that the weighting was really a political solution to a distribution formula to allocate revenue. All of them were. And so it was something that a group of people came together and said, here's what we believe can work. Because as I remember those days, you must have run 2,000 different formulas, with each weight changing and whatever, and every district coming back to the table, and every group that was there coming back to the table to say, we like that run better than this run, better than this run. And finally, after a long time, there was this agreement that these were the weights, and that's where it came from.
Chair Kopp, Representative Roblin, fortunately, I wasn't doing school finance then. Somebody else was doing all of those runs.
Oh.
But
they're probably somewhere in a nice warm spot now.
I agree that there was political give and take in that process.
Okay.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Steve, last session we worked on high-cost disability grant. Have we solved that? Is that better for the schools now? Is that still an issue?
Chair Kopp, Representative Wisnett, I don't know that it's still an issue. We worked on the high-cost disability by raising the threshold from $25,000 to
$30,000
and substantially reducing the number of students that the districts have to keep track of. There still will be more costs than dollars available for that grant. Because it's still $12 million cap per year.
Okay. Anything else, Steve, that you want to share with us?
One more quick slide, if I may.
Absolutely.
The last slide. This helps illustrate what the formula has done since it was adopted in 1991. If you look at the line that kind of angles up to the right, that's the 91-92 revenue per weighted student for school districts, when the school districts are ordered by costs. Mm-hmm. And also note that it's only districts with more than 500 ADM. If you had all students or all districts in this list, that line would go up to maybe $7,000 or $8,000 per weighted student. So it's just being reduced to keep it in perspective, the size of the graph. And then you can see that for 03-04 revenue per weighted student, it's almost horizontal, zigzagging up and down, but not very more than a few hundred dollars per weighted student because of those costs of transportation, et cetera, that aren't on a weighted student basis that Brian talked about. Okay. So now we have variation of a few hundred dollars. In 91-92, that variation was in the thousands of dollars. That's what equalization has done.
I was in a compression district, and it did a lot more than that.
Okay, Representative Dahlin, you want to make a comment to the equalization?
We were a very high, very rich district with grass seed farmers, and we went into compression, and we were spending about $8,000 per student when the rest of the state was spending $4,000, and it was painful. It hurt. It hurts right now. So it was... it was not just, but we did come into equity, and that was my questions to Mr. Reeder. Are we still at equity? And when we look at all the things, for example, when we give a special grant to the Portland Public Schools, the fear then was that if we didn't come into equity, we would have a lawsuit, which states around the nation were facing, and Oregon managed to dodge the bullet. And so it's imperative to me that an accident of birth ought not to give one of Oregon's students more money just because they happen to be born here or there. And that was the genesis of my question. Are we equitable on the coast, here in the capital, over on the east side, down in Ashland? And it's imperative that we stay there, that Oregon treat each and every one of its children as though they are equal.
And Representative Roblin, you're going to give us the message from above?
No, I'm just going to give a different definition of equity. I mean, I truly believe in equity. And from my perspective, equity isn't giving everybody exactly the same. It's giving them what they need to be successful at an equal amount. And that costs different amounts for different kids. The formula kind of expresses that with special ed, but it goes across. I mean, poverty is one of the issues that doesn't address much in our schedule, and yet we all know that you pay a big dividend for poor being in poverty and in education settings. And so, you know, I hope that we continue to really have discussions about equity, because from my perspective, it is a very, very large issue. And my hope is that, and it goes to the heart of one of Representative Dolan's issues, some of these very small schools are going to take a lot more money per kid just because they're out there. But saving them so that that student has the same opportunity to have courses and do things, i.e. equity in my event, is going to cost more than it is in some other places. And I think we have to make sure that we keep that in mind, because from my perspective, equity is a much bigger issue than making sure everybody gets the same number of dollars per kids out there. So.
Thank you, Representative Roblin. Steve, I thank you. Steve did print up a copy of his report. I did read his reports last night. They are quite well worth your time. If you want me to, I will get my staff to make copies for all of you so that you don't have to do that yourselves and just have that available. Okay. And because it's very well done, and a lot of really good information is in there about what is the impact of what we're doing. Representative Wisnett.
Does that include the history of the school distribution formulas? Did you give her that one?
Chair Copper, Representative Wisnett, it does not, but I can provide you.
I think that maybe the new member might appreciate that.
Yeah.
I have slides on the history.
Yeah. Because what the reports are focused on the impacts of the weighting for the special education program and the English second language learners. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Brian. Appreciate that. One of the things that I would hope that I will provide to the committee as part of of the bigger picture is when we talk about issues like this, that we have people that are directly impacted about by what our decisions may be and will be in the future. And so with that, I invited administrators from two districts, two local districts, one average size district in Woodburn, and then another one from Mill City Gates. And if I could have all four of you come up to the dais at one time, I think we can put an extra chair up there. We have Steve Nelson coming up. He's the business manager for San Yam Canyon School with his superintendent, Brad Yates. And from Woodburn School District, a good friend of mine, both of these wonderful people, educators, Denise Lapp is our business manager, and Walt Blomberg is our superintendent. And I asked them to share their perspective about how our budgeting process possibly works or doesn't work and anything that they might want to share. So it's an open forum. Steve, do you know about how much time you need to give your presentation? So I just wonder how much time we have for questions.
I have a presentation I wanted to read that takes about 10 minutes, but I know that's not necessarily the best way to do this, but with just a few days lead time, we decided to kind of lay out our thoughts and make sure we kind of had everything covered. So
Okay. Whatever's
best for you is...
Well, and if you might be able to summarize parts of it rather than read it all, that's great. And Denise or Walt?
Probably 10,
okay.
15 minutes
that's great.
Well.
Okay, thank you. Okay, well, Steve, you just do you have testimony available for us?
I do. I believe your assistant.
Okay, it's already
distributed.
Here.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Comte and committee members. I do appreciate the opportunity to come before you today. Again, my name is Steve Nielsen. I'm the business manager at the San Yam Canyon School District, and to my right is Superintendent Brad Yates. This is actually the first position I've had with school finance, but I've been with the district for 5.5 years. Prior to that, I worked for 7 years as a staff accountant and then controller at a private company here in Salem, so I've seen both sectors. Mr. Yates has been the superintendent of our school district for 10 years, and he's also been a superintendent of another small Oregon school district as well as a teacher, principal, and also a school board member for 10 years. So he has a wide variety of experience. We do represent a small school district up in the north of San Yam Canyon, serving the communities of Mill City, Gates, Detroit, and Idana, just 30 miles east of here on Highway 22. And we are a small school district, of course, which does represent 67% of those 198 school districts statewide. We are a poor socioeconomic area, and while we do serve 1,000 square miles geographically, our student enrollment currently sits at 630 students district-wide, serving three buildings. Over the last 11 years, our enrollment has dropped 30.6%. The student population in 1996-97 was 908 students, but due to the timber restrictions passed in the 90s, local economy was crippled and people lost their jobs and families moved away in droves. This story is not unique to us. Even though this was difficult to deal with, at least 83% of the enrollment drop was accounted for in the first 7 years of this period. Fortunately, enrollment was relatively flat during the economic downturn in the early part of this decade. It is dropping again, though, currently at an uncomfortable pace. The district implemented huge budget cuts during the late 90s due to the enrollment drop, which included closing a school, eliminating the music program, reducing administrative costs, and laying off staff. The district then appeared to be adequately prepared for the future, but just 2 years later, the national and state economy fell on hard times, which affected all Oregon school districts dramatically in the 01-03 and the 03-05 bienniums. Planning, budgeting, and rebudgeting many times during this period, as you know, was very tricky. Not only was the state appropriation not enough to meet current service levels, time and time again, the amount was slashed due to revenue shortfalls, particularly during the end of the 01-03 biennium. Like many districts around the state, we were forced to cut school days, five in our case, at the end of the 02-03 school year, just to stay in the black. We found ourselves in the same situation at the end of last school year, this time due to decreasing enrollment once again and to a lack of adequate appropriation. While the economy has stabilized over the past 2 years, the 050 state school fund appropriation was still inadequate to meet current service levels, much less allow for adding back programs and or investing in new ones. There are many issues that make this statement true. PERS, rising insurance costs, special education requirements, sick leave carryover from district to district, the possible impact of Senate Bill 300 and other unfunded mandates that create a need for funding and yearly increases more than most people think. I will speak to some of these issues in more detail later. We were excited to see the governor's budget proposal of $6.06 billion for the state school fund appropriation for the 07-09 biennium. If approved, this marks a significant step up in funding commitment to Oregon schools and will be a huge boost. The consensus among our constituents is that it will allow districts to meet current service levels and possibly add back some programs lost to the economic hardship over the past several years. Certain districts, especially increasing enrollment districts, may even be able to add new programs under this budget model. Decreasing enrollment districts like ours, and there are many, should be able to meet current service levels. And if I may make a comment, I do appreciate your question, Representative Cannon, on, you know, what's the definition of current service level? Because when I say current service level in this address, I'm saying based on the ratcheted down version, I would say that $6 billion is absolute minimum to meet what our definition of current essential budget level is now, not what it should be. I believe that 6.5 to 7 is probably more in the ballpark to get back to where we were based on a starting point of the 0001 year. So, and the reason that decreasing enrollment districts may not be able to make up the gap or even stable enrollment environments is because we need to rebuild our meager reserve funds that have been absolutely decimated by problems we've encountered the last 4 or 5 years, as well as trying to catch up on building repair and maintenance, which there's really no money for. Despite the hardships our district has experienced the past 11 years, our schools are performing very well in meeting current state and federal standards. Our elementary school in Gates, which is a K-4 school, has earned an exceptional rating on the state report card the past 2 years. Our middle and high schools have also received strong ratings in improving each of the past 2 years. The high school was just one of two mid-Willamette Valley high schools to achieve this high rating. It's very important to realize, however, that most of these gains have been achieved through supplemental programs funded by the federal government and not the state. At Gates, Superintendent Yates made a decision 7 years ago to invest federal Title I-A dollars into two distinct areas, full-day kindergarten, and to employ as many instructional aides as possible to service a new guided reading program. Both programs have proven to be very successful and the catalyst for the improved performance at Gates. We also have seen a marked improvement on benchmark tests as the first group of full-day kindergartners are now in the 8th grade. 70% of our classified staff, non-licensed personnel at Gates Elementary are currently employed by federal, title, or IDEA dollars. However, for the first time in recent memory, title dollars have been reduced as federal budgets are being cut due to natural disasters and war funding, and we're afraid this trend will continue. Without federal dollars, our district would lose many employees and vital programs critical to success. This is where the state must step up and do more, and the current state budget proposal would not be enough to make up for these losses if those were to occur. Our middle school and high school have also benefited tremendously from federal programs. We had 6 years ago a Comprehensive School Reform, or CSR grant, which is another federal grant that helped start a program called Accelerated Schools, which is now still performing at a lesser extent as part of the teacher's regular contract. And now our high school, Santiam High School, has a 2-year comprehensive school reform grant that has allowed us to start a new program called Read Write, which is a very dynamic reading program and this is the second of a two-year funding commitment for that. But that program alone, along with a couple of other changes that were made at the high school, resulted in the high school going from a poor to a strong rating last year. Right now, people in the students that are in that reading program, for every 6.9 hours they spend in the reading program, they increase one grade level in their reading ability. Of course, at the end of this year, those dollars will be gone, and we would like to be able to fund that, you know, because it's such a huge program with the additional state budget, but we don't know if we'll be able to do that due to the other items that we have to backfill and our enrollment problems. The other thing that the high school I wanted to mention was that we did implement a no D grade, and that has helped as well in our performance. The other issue I mentioned a few moments ago was the lack of repair and maintenance dollars. The most significant investment in our buildings and equipment in the last 5 years was also due to a federal school improvement and renovation grant. We received dollars to redo our roof at the middle school, and then we received dollars as part of the special ed part of that to purchase two handicap accessible minivans to transport some of our severe needs kids. And again, those came from federal dollars. We believe that recent PERS reform and an increased budget for the 07-09 biennium are serious steps in the right direction. And in talking with our other LBL ESD component school districts, we generally agree that $6.0 billion is the absolute minimum baseline to meet, again, the current service level, the deteriorated service level. There is a certain level of disagreement about whether or not additional funds above the $6 billion should have strings attached or not. We believe those additional funds are critical, and there are many areas that they can be earmarked for. So we don't necessarily have a problem with that philosophy as a district. It is important to consider, though, that each individual district is somewhat of an entity unto its own and have all made tough decisions over the years with regards to programs, facilities, and staff. So a certain amount of flexibility is important when it comes to this issue. We believe that money with strings attached is better than no money at all. So we believe the biggest and the bigger picture and most important issue has yet to be dealt with. That is the part, the stable part of school funding. We hear the words adequate and stable funding all the time. While it appears that the adequate part is being addressed, we've still yet to hear a viable solution for the stable part of the equation. We all know that a number is nice, but there are no guarantees that we will see that number when the biennium is all said and done with. We only need to look back to 0103 and 0305 to get that sad reminder. The last I saw, Oregon depends on, and I appreciate the comments you made to in review, Representative Minnis, on what happened in 0103 and 0305 and income taxes and such, but I believe Oregon relies on one single income source as a percentage of its total more than any other state other than Alaska, which is really its own unique entity. And the fact that income source is income taxes is really risky and scary to have education and kids tied to. And I think that's really the crux of the matter. And I know that a lot of discussions took place in previous sessions, but I don't believe anything was really able to get hammered out. And I guess that's the biggest thing for most school districts is to get the stability and the predictability. We do have some other concerns listed that I took the time over the last few days to discuss with other districts that feed into our ESD, the Lynn Benton Lincoln ESD. And we have districts that range from sizes from us, real small, like Alsea, all the way to Greater Albany and Lincoln County. And, you know, even though there are small school versus big school issues out there, we do generally agree on a lot of items. And I won't take the time to read that, but there are some special education comments, and actually the first part actually addresses the concern on that and addresses a question that Representative Wisnant asked to Mr. Meyer. And We all generally disagree with the idea of a statewide health pool. We don't believe that will save money, and I've gone into detail there in my narrative. We're concerned about Senate Bill 300, the inconsistency in the way weighted programs work between ESL and special education students. And as a small district, I guess we'd like to put in our good word to say we would really appreciate continuation of the small schools grant that is currently distributed for 07, 09, and beyond. We would love to see the reinstatement of the school improvement grant, which went away at the end of the 01, 03 biennium, I believe, which was used for books, technology, and buildings, non-personnel type items. And we would also support, because I know it was talked about last session, the elimination of federal forest revenue receipts from the state school fund equation. So
that's going to happen.
Anyway, I do appreciate the opportunity to come and visit with you today, and we're available to answer any questions.
Okay. Because I think what we'll do is hear the information from Woodburn. And the reason why I asked both of these districts to come is San Diego Canyon is definitely losing students, and Woodburn's a growth district. But before we leave San Diego Canyon, I have a question. I know both of you probably know the answer. How much money does your fundraiser gain every year for your scholarship fund for your high school?
This year it was $30,000.
$30,000 from their community in one night?
One night.
One night. Of course, I only donated $50, I think.
it all goes to scholarships for seniors.
Yeah.
It goes right into the senior class.
Wow. What you see in a small community, as many people that sit at this dais truly knows, that the heart of the city is in that school. So, appreciate your work. Superintendent Blomberg.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman. My name is Walt Blomberg. I'm the superintendent of schools in Woodburn, and with me is Denise Slapp, our business manager. I think the reason that Betty invited me is that our students benefit probably the very most percentage-wise from the current school funding formula. It is not to be denied, but I think in the context of that, you have to remember exactly what you're asking of us. And you're asking that all kids at all levels achieve at the same standard. And that means regardless of socioeconomic status, regardless of whether they come to our schools with English language abilities, regardless of any circumstance that these kids have in their life, they will all achieve in the third grade the same, to the same standard, to the fifth grade the same standard, eighth grade same standard, tenth grade same standard, and when they graduate from our schools, they will all have the same level of skills. Now, your point was well taken, Representative Robin, because it takes more to invest in certain kids to get to that same standard at the same time. Because basically our system is measured against kids that grew up here, grew up with English, grew up with some middle class affluency, and that's our standard. So how do you get the kids that don't have that to the standard? You know, the question is, does it take more money to educate kids in poverty, to educate kids who do not have English as their first language? And the answer is yes. It's a resounding yes. And I think the committee, way back when they were developing this formula, came up with the same answer. And I'd like to share with you, and I've given you some, I think, reasons why certain students take more money to educate than others. And if you look at the first, you know, does it cost more to educate kids in poverty? Well, many of these kids come with very limited preschool experiences because of their circumstances. They possess limited basic skills often when they enter our schools. If you were to give many of our kids from low socioeconomic status, and we have about 90% free and reduced lunch, you would find that these kids may not come at the same level as the kids in West Lynn or Lake Oswego or even Oregon City and possibly Mill City.
Walt, can I ask you to just step
up? Oh, back a little bit?
From the okay. Because we're getting that feedback.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for telling me. These kids need more personalized instruction. Class sizes
have to be somewhat lower for these kids. The adults that work with these kids need additional staff development in order to understand what these kids are going through and what it is, what it takes in order to make sure they get the skills. It requires also additional administrative oversight to oversee programs for these students. And what is Woodburn School District? How do we spend the money that we get for kids in poverty? Well, we also provide full-day, everyday kindergarten for all of our students. We invest a week prior to kindergarten, orienting not only the students but the families to life in school, because many have not had preschool experiences. We try to maintain class sizes that are below state average. Our goal in kindergarten is 23. Provide after-school clubs so we extend the students' day, because these kids need, in many cases, as much instructional time as we can give them. We do that through book clubs. We do it through math tutoring. We also provide summer schools. We not only extend their day, but we extend their year. And again, we hire administrators to make sure that we oversee federal programs, and the requirements of those programs have not diminished over time. Does it cost more to educate students with limited or no English? You know, a lot of these are probably obvious, but the answer to that is yes. Again, many of these kids also require specialized programs with administrative leadership, people that know what it takes to help kids gain a second language. It requires teachers who have specialized training in second language acquisition. And can you imagine that our colleges don't do this yet? With only a little over 9% of the state students who are ESL students, the system, the state system of higher education, is not on board 100% with ensuring that the teachers come out with the basic instructional strategies to help students who are ESL. And so we invest a lot of resources in training staff as they enter our system, because many of them are not trained when they enter. Requires looking for bilingual teachers. All the time we're trying to bridge the language gap. Kids come with a language other than English, and we need staff that can communicate not only with the kids, but with the parents as well. Providing small classes, again, personalized instruction is important for these students. It requires additional technology. Most people didn't think of this, but we have much more testing going on in our district. If you haven't heard of the ELPA, which is an English language proficiency assessment, that's all done on computers. We have over 50% of our students who are English language learners who have to somehow have access to computers to assess twice a year, in addition to all the state assessments that go on. So we've had to invest in more computers, mobile labs. We've also had to specialize our curriculum. We can't pull curriculum out of a book somewhere. We have to analyze it and adjust it, adapt it, and it takes extra money, staff time, to make sure that our curriculum addresses the needs of ESL students. It definitely requires more paperwork. We're giving much more initially when parents come in. We're doing language assessments. We're doing home language surveys. It takes time for staff time in particular, to ensure that all of these requirements are accomplished. Translations. We translate everything in three languages. Federal law requires us to communicate with parents in a language that they understand. It's not all about our students. It's about oftentimes making sure that their parents are informed, because parents, you may know, most of you would agree how important parents are in the educational success of students. And so we have to make sure we're communicating well with them. But we also translate for our students in instruction. We spent over $90,000 translating science materials, because you can't buy them off the shelf.
Walt?
Yes.
Regretfully, there's another committee that meets in this room in 6 minutes.
Okay.
Can you just really tell us one or two?
Well, if
really
you haven't gotten the picture yet, then I haven't done my job.
But seriously.
The investment it takes, the reason you have a funding formula that weights kids, is exactly for the reasons I'm stating. It costs more money to help kids reach the same standard as any other kid in the system. We cannot hold kids accountable because some of the barriers that they face. Equity is about the end. You know, the end in mind, that we want these kids to be able to go into our workforce, to be productive citizens, and we have to ensure that they can get there. regardless of any barriers they bring. And so we invest, it takes the investment of these dollars in a system that supports those kids as well as everybody else in order to achieve that.
And, yes, and before we close, just two comments. Brad, could you state your name for the record? Since you spoke out loud, you have to record your name.
Brad Yates, Superintendent Sam King.
Thank you. And that I would really, when you get the report that we're going to print up that Steve has identified, and I guess that's why some of you will find my passion very, very strong about education and our needs. I did read that report last night, and most districts have maybe 9 to 15 to 18% of their students that are learning English as a second language. Our district in Woodburn has, it says very clearly in there, 69% of our students are learning English as a second language. So when we get a little passionate,
absolutely,
that's part of why we do what we do, and I just appreciate everybody that was here in attendance today. And please bring your laptops on Tuesday. We are going to have a demonstration of the assessments for all students, including, I don't know if we're going to do, I know we're going to do Tessa and a couple of others, so please bring your laptops.
Hunter.
Yes.
Can I just request that if there are presentations, you gentlemen are really good about bringing hard copies, but it's good if somebody's going to do a presentation on an overhead, if they would
also
have
yes.
papers accompanying it. I appreciate that.
Thank you, Representative Minnis. This informational meeting is now adjourned.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So I don't have to go
very
far.
I get the right turn.
And that I work 6 years running an active 20 program in Northern California.
Okay. I think you're Weber. Yeah.